Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. Let's get this show on the road. This is Solder Smoke 101. It's the 15th of February, 2009, 0500 Universal Coordinated Time, and I'm speaking to you from Rome, Italy. Last time we spoke, it was Super Bowl Sunday, and I had completely forgotten about it. This is what happens when you live outside the USA for a long time. You do have a tendency to lose touch. Not that I was ever really a big sports fan, but I know listeners in the States might find it difficult to believe that somebody could forget that it was Super Bowl Sunday. But when I spoke to you 2 weeks ago, I had forgotten. I remembered later in the day, and Billy and I did our bit to support American football here in Rome, Italy. We did what we what we've been doing quite frequently, and that is we headed out to the piazza, the plaza, the square. Italian life in many ways is built around the piazza. It's a very communal kind of thing. That's where you go out and where the kids play. We have a market in our piazza, and there's also benches where mostly the old folks sit in the afternoon, and but everybody just kind of gets together in the piazza. There's stores and restaurants located around it. It's a wonderful thing, and it's one of the many pleasures of life in Italy, just getting into piazza life, and we are certainly into it. There's a little playground on our piazza, and Billy and Maria have been playing on there and enjoying it ever since we got here. It's where they ride their bikes. They can ride their bikes around the piazza. The piazza is where it's at in Italy, guys, let me tell you. And Billy and I will frequently go out there and throw around an American football on Piazza di San Cosimato. This does get us some stares. You don't see too many American footballs flying across Italian piazzas, but we throw one across ours, and actually it provokes some interesting reactions. The Italian kids who see us doing this, they're really curious, and they'll often come up and say, "What are you doing?" Because for them, what you do with a ball is you kick it. This is a very, what we'd call in the States, I guess, soccer-centric country. It's more than soccer-centric. It's a soccer fanatic. It's calcio. Calcio, or football, or what we call soccer, is the national passion here. And it's so deeply ingrained that when kids see us using our hands to play catch, they'll literally come up to us sometimes and say, "What are you doing?" You know, and then if Billy asks one of them if he wants to kind of play, we'll toss him the ball. The first thing he'll do is throws it on the floor and tries to kick it. Anyway, so we're a bit outside the norm here with the throwing spirals. I must say we throw some beautiful spirals, and this is the thing that one of the other pleasures about Italy. Everybody's very expressive, and there's a keen sense of a keen appreciation here for beauty and grace and kind of symmetry, and it's all summed up by the whole concept of bella figura. And bella figura, I have found, can even be applied to a beautiful spiral going across the Piazza di San Cosimato, because if Billy throws a good one or if I throw a good one and it just kind of sails across and reaches the receiver, Italians who are walking by will often just give you a very spontaneous "bravo" or Bravi, bravissimi. So, anyway, that's one way that we were commemorating Super Bowl Sunday here in Rome. The other thing, and this is a kind of very Roman celebration of football. At the same time, I happened to be reading a book by John Grisham. I don't read a lot of novels. I don't read a lot of John Grisham novels. As you know, my reading is usually focused on Sprat Magazine and QRP Quarterly and technical topics from G3VA, things like that. But, well, every once in a while, you got to add a little variety to life, guys. So I was reading Playing for Pizza by John Grisham. This is a novel that Grisham wrote about Italy, specifically about an American quarterback, an American NFL quarterback who was kind of down on his luck in the NFL and then desperately looking for a way to continue to play professional football, was hired by a team in northern Italy known as the Parma Panthers. Now, many of you guys are going to find this shocking, but there is a professional American football league. Well, I guess it's sort of semi-pro, and I'll explain in a minute, here in Italy. They have about 10 or 12 teams. It's mostly in the north, but there is a team in Rome. The Roman team is called the Roman Gladiators. Grisham based his novel on a real football league. And most of the teams are, well, all the teams are mostly Italian, but almost all of them, I think they're allowed to have up to three American players. And the American players are usually guys brought in from the NFL. It's usually the quarterback, maybe one of the running backs, and sometimes, I think most of the time, the coach. And they play American football here in Italy, and they have an organized league. They've been playing for many years. They have an Italian Super Bowl. And you can read all about it in a very entertaining form in Playing for Pizza by John Grisham. I enjoyed the book. It's light. It's an easy read. It's kind of fun. It gives you a few insights about Italy and about the interaction between American culture and Italian culture. I enjoyed it. As I said, I'm not a big sports fan, and this is really, it's been a bit of a problem for me because I come from a real sports family. Now, I'll tell you, I haven't mentioned this before, but I'm very proud of it, actually. My grandfather played for the New York Yankees, played baseball for the New York Yankees. He was a professional baseball player. And you can find him in the baseball encyclopedia. I know at least a few of you guys are baseball or sports nuts, and check it out. Baseball Encyclopedia, last name spelled Mara, M-E-A-R-A. You'll find my grandfather, Charles Mara. His nickname was Groggy, and he played for the New York Yankees. Check him out. My dad played professional baseball, too, up in Canada after the Second World War. Came back from the war, and he loved baseball and got picked up by a minor league team and played many years, very happily. I think he played 5 years for the Kingston Ponies in Kingston, Ontario, and loved it. Time of his life. Really, really, it was great. We have all kinds of baseball memorabilia from my dad's days up there, and fond memories of Kingston and Ontario and the Kingston Ponies. I inherited none of this, guys. None of this. Absolutely zero. I couldn't catch a fly ball. When we played baseball, I was always stuck out in left field where I could do minimal damage. It was really bad. I didn't realize at the time, but of course now we know I had the knack. All right. Enough travelogue, enough sports talk. On to the radios. This is sort of related to travelogue, but I finished reading Empire of the Air. I was reading it kind of slowly as I because I'm reading all this other stuff at the same time. But I really enjoyed the book, and I finished it on a train to Naples. I had to go down to Naples last week. It's about a 2.5-3 hour drive, or just I guess like an hour and a half train ride. I took the train down, very pleasant, and I sat there with the book Empire of the Air and finished it as the train rolled through southern Lazio and into Campania. and on to Naples. I really enjoyed the book. Well done. As I said, I kind of give it 4 stars for very strong on biography, very strong on history. A little light in the knack department. The author isn't a real tech guy, but all's to be forgiven because he really makes up for what he lacks on the technical side with real strength in, well, obviously real strength in writing and biography and history. So strongly recommend it. I've gotten a lot of email about from guys who also enjoyed the book or wanted a comment on it. Mike, KC7IT, sent in this morning a review that he wrote about the book in 1992 and also links to some sites about Armstrong and the book. I found the site that he sent in about Armstrong to be really amazing. All kinds of pictures of original schematic diagrams and gear that Armstrong was working on. I liked it so much, I'm putting it up on the blog. You'll see a picture of Armstrong's original regen receiver and links to the site. It's really worth going through the site. It gives you a real sense of what was going on, the history, the communications, the interaction between the strong personalities that were involved. I guess I came away from the book, I guess, with the more firmly convinced than ever that Armstrong was the real, of course, was the real hero, and he was really treated very, very badly by the legal system and by the other two personalities involved, by DeForest and by Sarnoff. I never really had any kind of a high opinion about DeForest, and that low opinion was confirmed by reading Empire of the Air. I don't even think DeForest had the knack. in the beginning of the book, I came to have a higher opinion of Sarnoff because of his real up from nothing, immigrant makes good background, and also because he was obviously a person of real foresight who probably before anybody else realized the potential for the use of radio as an entertainment medium and for broadcasting. This was something that almost no one had thought of, and there are memos from Sarnoff, I think, going back to 1915, in which he talks about how what he called radio music boxes could be placed in the homes to replace the piano and the Victrolas. And he also calculated, you know, how much money RCA could make from the these radio music boxes. But in the end, I have to say, Sarnoff really turned on his old friend Armstrong because they were friends for many years, and I think it really hurt Armstrong the way Sarnoff really turned his back on Armstrong. And a couple of really poignant moments towards the end of the book, one in which they recount that when Sarnoff was informed of Armstrong's suicide, his first reaction was kind of an angry, defiant, "I did not kill Howard Armstrong." Well, obviously those around him were thinking that he certainly contributed to the death. The other thing was that at Armstrong's funeral, the Sarnoff was apparently really distraught and in tears. So I think he may have realized what he had done. But also, it's an interesting view of the U.S. Patent system and what goes on there. And you get a sense of how tedious it must have been, awful it must have been for Armstrong to have to spend all those years defending himself in court. Just lawyers using all kinds of lawyerly tricks to try to take his inventions away from him. Anyway, a great book. Really recommend it. It's full of all kinds of great insights. And take a look at the website that I'm going to put up on the page that describes Armstrong's inventions and provides all kinds of pictures, great pictures of him up on the antennas. And man, he was a real hands-on guy. One thing I haven't found out, and I'm sure somebody out there knows it, and please send it to me. What was Howard Armstrong's amateur radio call sign? So please send that along. I'd like to know what his call was. I wonder, if it's possible. Let's see. Yeah, I guess it was possible. Is anybody out there? Did anybody actually work them? Does anybody have a QSO or a QSL card from Howard Armstrong? That'd be interesting. Hey, speaking of regens, in the last episode, let me see if there's anything else on that. Yeah, okay. Well, I think now we can move on. Yeah. Oh, well, one more thing on the whole history of early radio. I found a website. Actually found a YouTube video called Electrons on Parade by the Radio Corporation of America. And it's really amazing. It's from 1941, and it describes the role that vacuum tubes played in life in 1941 and how the vacuum tubes were manufactured. Really a great piece of commercial propaganda. Very entertaining. It's filled with all kinds of 1930s, 1940s slang, and there's all kinds of great scenes in there. I was really taken by how hands-on the manufacturer of the tubes was back then. It wasn't at all as automated as I expected. People were in there actually, kind of almost sewing together the grid portions of the tubes and placing the various components of the triodes and the pentodes inside on the base before the glass envelope was formed. Really interesting stuff. There's one scene in the movie. Watch for it. It's in part two. Part two is really good because in part two of the videos you get to see the intrepid radio amateurs in action. Out there, saving people from floods and other natural disasters and all that kind of stuff. And at one point, they show how radio is being used by law enforcement agencies to capture the bad guys. And you see this scene where a bunch of G-men apparently jump into their car and speed off in pursuit of gangsters or something. And the thing is, you see the police car kind of pull out of the parking lot, and the wheels are spinning, and it's fishtailing, and it's going down the road. And in the movie, he damn near takes out this little kid on a bicycle. It just keeps on going. I mean, it was really scary. And then, a couple seconds later, they show you the G-men out there with the Tommy guns blasting away at Al Capone and the boys and all that kind of stuff. But check it out, Electrons on Parade. It's up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. All right, now on to the actual melting of solder here in Rome, Italy. Since we last spoke, I went ahead and built the transmitter portion of my ET1 FET. This is the minimalist transceiver that I told you about in the last episode. A picture of it with just the receiver portion is up on the blog page. I'll try to get a picture with the transmitter portion, but the transmitter only adds about, 7 or 8 parts, and they're just around the back. It's a crystal-controlled transmitter. I've got a rock for 3579 on the board, and I used, for the key, maybe I should get a picture up of this thing, but I found one of these little contact switches. It's a switch, I think, that's supposed to be used for doors or something. Anyway, it's a little switch. It's got a little spring-loaded actuator in it. And I never knew what I was going to do with these things, but I just soldered it right on the board, and that becomes the key. Hold on a second. I meant to play this for you. Let me turn everything on here for a second. I gotta wait for the Drake 2B to warm up, guys, because I want to actually let you listen to what the transmitter sounds like. Tubi is warming up, and I've turned on the ET1. The ET1 is powered, by the way, by there's a Tubi. It's powered by a power supply that used parts from provided to me by Tony Fishpool in the UK. I bought a case for for an old power supply at the Kempton Park Rally outside London. You can probably hear the 2B. Something awful. Wow. Right on 3579, too. Anyway, Tony, in his great book, Test Gear for the Radio Amateur, had a good circuit in there for a current-controlled power supply. And I think Tony sent me the chip that was at the heart of it. So anyway, that's what's powering up the ET1. All right, let's see here now. Some sort of radio teletype there. But you should probably be able to hear me over it. I should be strong enough. I hope my own rig is strong enough. Hold on. There you go. How's that? That's the ET1. That's the transmitter. Actually transmitting and being picked up across the room here in the Drake 2B. And put it back on receive. There you go. Anyway, CW sounds good. The receiver, I haven't made any contacts with it. To tell you the truth, I haven't even really tried. But I'm pleased that I've got the transmitter going. I'm pleased that I can receive stuff at all with the receiver. It's very easy to hear CW signals on 80 meters, and they actually sound quite good. But I have some problems, and I have some questions about this, and I want to pass them on to the group here. Maybe some of you guys with more regen experience can help. I played around with regens over the years, and every time I do, I find myself having a deeper appreciation about of why Howard Armstrong worked so hard to invent the super hat to get beyond the problems just inherent in using a regen. But my regen receiver works okay, but I had to modify the circuitry a bit to get it to work. Let me reach over here. See if I can. I don't have them handy, but the circuit that recently appeared in Sprat, the FE tier, that circuit employed a crystal high impedance headphone, and what that design did was it just put the high impedance crystal headphone kind of in parallel between what happens is from the 12 volt source you have a resistor that comes down to I have a version of the schematic on the blog page, so you can follow along a little bit if you'd like. But in the FE tier, you have the 12-volt source, a resistor, and then a 100 microhenry RF choke. The Hi-Z crystal headphone goes between the resistor and the RF choke, and you just put the Hi-Z crystal headphone at that point, the other terminal, to ground. So you're basically just sampling the audio voltage coming across the resistor there, and that's what you listen to. I didn't have any Hi-Z crystal headphones here. I think the only really kind of suitable headphones that I had were an old set of cans. I thought they were high impedance. They were very sensitive, and they were the same ones that I used when building crystal radios with Billy in London. So they were suitable for use with crystal receivers. So they must be pretty sensitive. But when I measured the DC resistance, it was quite low. It was only around, 200 ohms. not the high Z that I thought I would find. But they're still very sensitive, and but what I had to do is I had to go and take a look at the circuitry from the original ET1 that appeared in Spratt, I think back in 1992 or so. And in that circuit, the designer, W2UW, has the 12 volts DC coming down through a resistor, and then the DC flows through the headphones. So the headphones are in series with the 12 volt DC, and then it goes to the 100 microhenry choke. Now, when I hooked it up that way, the receiver started to work, and I could hear CW signals with it. But the problem is now that I have this big set of headphones with two big coils there in the earpieces. So this affects the resonant frequency of the receiver. And when I move that headset around, or if I move the cord for the headset, I'm shifting frequency. This is life with a regen, guys. This is what you have to deal with, and it just goes with the territory. You know, I find myself thinking, oh man, this is easy. I'll just throw in some sort of high input impedance amplifier circuit, and I'll have it in there, and that'll improve the isolation, and I'll be able to get a little bit more audio out. But then, of course, I'm defeating the purpose because I'm adding another active device. And the whole point of this thing is to do everything with one field effects transistor, one MPF 102. So whenever I find myself thinking about throwing in an additional transistor or even an LM386 audio amplifier chip or something like that, I have to kind of remind myself that the name of the game here is one FET. So if anybody has any suggestions on how I can take care of this audio problem, or where I can get some high Z crystal headphones, let me know. I've got all kinds of little earbud headphones around the shack, but when I measure them, they all seem to be quite low Z. Usually they seem to measure DC resistance of about 40 or 50 ohms, but no high Z devices around here. So let me know what you think. Also, when I'm listening to CW signals with my little one FET regen receiver, you know, I as you have to do, I fool around with the feedback level to try to get it pretty close to the sweet spot. If we were listening to AM, if we were listening to AM broadcast, I could set the regeneration quite low, just below the point of oscillation, where you'd have kind of a maximum, maximum sensitivity and maximum Q for the tuned circuit there. So it would get quite sensitive and quite selective. But of course, when you're listening to CW, you have to actually run it so that the regen stage is actually in oscillation, or else you wouldn't be able to hear the audio. Because what's going on now is, I guess in the old days of Spark, they didn't have to do this. They could leave it below the oscillation point, and the raspiness of the non-continuous kind of the decrement, they called it, the decrement of the spark signal would allow you to hear the buzzing. It would sound just like a buzzing sound coming through. But with CW, if you don't have that regen stage oscillating, there's not going to be any really discernible audio coming out. Maybe you'd hear a little bit of, you know, tss, 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 but you're not going to hear any kind of tone. To get the audio tone, you need to let that stage go into low-level oscillation, so that the signal coming in on 3579 mixes with the signal from your regen at 3578 and produces a 1KC tone that you can hear in your headphones. So it's really quite neat when you think about it. The that little 1FET that I have in there is functioning as RF amplifier. It's also the BFO, and it's also the mixer. and it's producing audio that goes right to the headphones. So you've got a lot of things happening simultaneously in that one little FET. But here's the thing: even when I have it adjusted sort of optimally, the CW tones that I get aren't really that clean. There's a bit of raspiness in it, and also, I think I know what's causing this. If I have the Drake 2B on at the other side of the shack, as I tune my regen around, every once in a while I'll hear the oscillations from the regen. And the tone of the oscillations in the Drake 2B is quite rough. It's not at all a clean tone. So I think what's happening is that when the FET goes into oscillation, it's not at all kind of sine wave. It's rough. There's all kinds of junk and harmonics in there, so that when the signal comes in from the antenna, it's mixing with quite a rough signal. I'm wondering if there's any way to deal with that on a simple one stage a regen. Any suggestions would be appreciated. This also makes copying SSB signals pretty much impossible. I mean, I can hear the Donald Duck chatter in there, but when I try to tune this thing to the point where I could listen to an SSB signal, it's really, really rough. Part of it is the lack of good frequency stability. I mean, if I move anything even slightly, it causes the frequency of the device to shift, and you really need a lot more stability in your local oscillators to copy SSB properly. But it might also be this dirty or harmonic laden oscillation that I have going on. Again, if anybody's got any ideas on how to deal with this in a simple one active device circuit, let me know. And finally, there's one other kind of issue that I have now with the device. Ever since I put the transmitter circuitry in there, and let's listen to it again. Is that magnificent? Yeah, ever since I did that, every once in a while I'm blowing up MPF 102s. The thing will just die on me, and I'll realize that what's died is the FET. So I have a couple of suspicions about what might be doing this. One, it might be just because I've built this whole thing on top of a big relay. You know, when I switch over from T to R, there might be a big jolt coming from that coil in the relay. I've blown up many active devices, many bits of circuitry with the electromagnetic jolt from the relay coil before. There are many dead NE602 chips around the shack here that resulted from my failure to deal with the pulse of the caused by the decaying magnetic field around the relay coil. There's tricks to deal with this. I mean, you put a diode, a reverse bias diode, across the terminals of the relay, and what happens then is that when the field collapses, when you turn that relay off and the field collapses, instead of having the current from the collapsing field go through your circuitry, it just goes through the diode there, and that's that. You can also put a capacitor there across it to help deal with the jolt. I've got the capacitor, I've got the diode there, but I still seem to be killing MPF 102s. The other thing I thought was that I might have been running the on transmit, I might have been running it a bit too hot. I might have had a bit too much voltage across the MPF 102, and that might be be causing the demise of the FETs. I have a pretty large box of MPF 102s here, so I could go for quite a while, but I'd like to stop stop eating them up in this way. And if anybody has any suggestions, let me know. I still need to build. I just realized this morning. I still need to build the low pass filter, because I think even at 15 milliwatts, I should put a low pass filter in there. The guys from Spratt will be pleased to hear me say that. They're always reminded me that low pass filters are definitely needed, and they're absolutely right. When I look at the waveform at the output of this thing going into the dummy load, it's really quite ugly. It needs some low pass filtering. Anyway, that's where we stand with the ET1 FET here. This is all part, of course, of the minimalist revolution that has been sweeping ham radio, or at least the homebrew corners of it. Guys, I think this is the next big thing, or the next little thing. Probably, yeah, it's the next little thing. QRSS is big and will continue to be big, and it's great fun because it's the kind of thing that you could do unattended. You could be on the air doing other things, working around the house, walking the dog or whatever, and still be heroically transmitting QRP signals around the world in QRSS mode. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the latest thing, and I think several people out there to blame for this, I'll mention them in a minute, is minimalist radio. And that's what's going on here with my ET1 FET here. Building radios with the minimum number of active devices. And guys, this brings us to one of the people I think most responsible for this new version of the knack that's afflicting many of us. And of course, I refer to Alpha Alpha 1 Tango Juliet, Mike Rainey, the QRP poet laureate, hero of the Hobbit Hole, who works, by the way, in an underground bunker in Vermont. And my kids are, Billy especially, is quite impressed that that Mike's shack is heated by one light bulb. I guess it's being heated by an incandescent bulb, but putting one of those CFL bulbs in there wouldn't really do too well for the heating. And I guess in Vermont these days you would need some heating there in the underground ham shack. But anyway, Mike has been, as listeners to Solder Smoke will know, Mike has been providing the ham radio community with great ideas and inspiration here for several years now, since his return to the hobby after an absence of far too many years. But anyway, he's back with us and coming up with great ideas. He was the one who alerted everybody to the fact that you could turn compact fluorescent light bulbs into 80 meter transmitters. Who would have known? but you can. He produced the Reggie and many other rigs, and the latest is the Mikums, Mikums. Now, guys, brace yourself, because we're going to talk about ham radio history in the making here. The Mikums is an 80-meter CW transceiver using one tunnel diode. Mike was did some revolutionary work on the use of the negative resistance properties of tunnel diodes to create oscillators and to create devices that would actually produce radio waves. And he's got one in there. It's a 1N3718, and he's got it in there in a little, looks like a little Colpitts oscillator configuration. And he had a transmitter running with this device for a while, and was getting some reports on it. But with the Mikums, he takes things to a new stage and uses this one device as a transmitter and a receiver. He's got a transceiver using this one device, It's got a direct conversion receiver in there, and a couple diodes for a couple additional diodes for the direct conversion receiver. But the energy, the local oscillator energy for the DC receiver comes from the tunnel diode, and the tunnel diode, of course, provides the all of the of the power for the transmitter when the device when the MCMS is switched to transmit. MCMS comes from the name of the cat of Reginald Fessenden. Reginald Fessenden, of course, one of the pioneers of radio, the guy who gave us the famous Christmas Eve 1906 voice broadcast that really must have been a shock. Can you imagine being out there on a ship at sea, listening to accustomed to listening to spark and spark code transmissions? That's all you've ever heard on radio, and then all of a sudden, from your headphones, you hear the human voice and music, and that's what Reginald Fessenden did, among many other things. Anyway, Fessenden and his crew had a cat, and it was named MCMS. And if I've read the story correct, it's named for Michael Faraday. And MCMS is kind of an affectionate nickname for Michael MCMS. Anyway, there's a picture that Mike has on his website showing the crew, Reginald Fessenden's team, and Fessenden's young son is sitting there, is pictured there holding the cat, MCMS. So very appropriately, Michael names the new rig MCMS. An aside, I have to pause here for a second. Talking about names, I did something pretty bad. When my kids got the gerbils, I was thinking about what to name them. And then for some reason, Dot and Dash came into my head. But then I didn't realize that the reason that Dot and Dash was in my head was because a friend had told me that he too had used the name, had used those nicknames before. So I said, all right, look, we got to rename the gerbils because, it just wouldn't be right. Anyway, so we have renamed the gerbils here. And after reading Empire of the Air, I think you guys might know what the names of the gerbils are. And one is known as DeForest, and the other is known as Sarnoff. Right? Sarnoff and DeForest, basically, also I must point out there was a mistake, because when we got them from the gerbil store here in downtown Trastevere, they assured us that both of them were of the same gender. And to the delight of my kids, we discovered this week that was not the case. So now, if any of you guys are interested in some gerbils, we have them. But the names Sarnoff and DeForest, the names are taken. Oh, by the way, Lake DeForest that I grew up near, I was relieved to know. Many guys wrote in and did some research. They were far better at Googling than I was, and it was not named for Lee. Whew, what a relief. I did not grow up on the banks of Lake Lee DeForest. It was another DeForest, the guy who developed the area and decided to flood the Hackensack River to create the lake. So Lee was not involved. Good thing. All right, back to MCMS. I have the circuit diagram in front of me. Guys, let me tell you, it's impressive. It's impressive in its bold simplicity. This is bare bones radio, minimalist to the max. And even more impressive is that Mike actually had a QSO with this thing. The power level, approximately 165 microwatts. That's micro with an M, microwatts. 165 microwatts. Michael was transmitting. I think he had it in beacon mode, and I think he got a call from our friend Siab Alpha Alpha One, Mike Yankee, who is 100 miles from Michael's underground bunker under the snows of Vermont. And anyway, they got the phone call. Mike was very excited, got on the air, and sure enough, he could hear Siab, and Siab could hear him. So this was we think, the first ever SkyWave QSO using a tunnel diode transceiver. History was made in ham radio. Congratulations to Mike and to CAB. We have the QSL card for the contact up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, and also Mike's very enthusiastic email reporting on the QSO. I really got a kick out of Mike's email. When you guys read it, you'll immediately identify with the excitement. You could just sense the excitement that he must have felt, and the real happiness with which he typed out this this email reporting to us about the exciting QSO. So yeah, I think it was great, and again, it's inspiring many of us to get into minimalist mode. As a matter of fact, there is now a new Yahoo group out there, Minimalist Ham Radio. Many people are signed up for it. We've got about 122 members right now. Just do a search, Minimalist Radio. I have a link to it on if you scroll through the blogspot.com page. There's a link that takes you to the Minimalist Ham Radio webpage of the Yahoo group, and you can sign up. You can sign up there. Let's see. Wow, we're rambling here. I got to move on. We got a lot of things to cover. SOT, Jerry Feltz, NR5A, had sent me an email talking about minimalist radio. He'd been looking at some circuits, and he came across a few bits of British terminology that required translation. Now, I've been away for about a year and a half, and my British is getting a bit rusty. So I knew what a 3M3 resistor was, and that's a 3.3 mega ohm resistor. And that kind of British radio terminology didn't escape me. But here's one that stumped me. SOT. What does SOT mean? I kind of guessed. It looked to me like there were parts where the designer couldn't be quite sure what component you should use, but you should just play around with different component values till you find one that works. This is especially suitable for regen receivers, where you know there's no way the designer could tell what the exact values of the lead capacitances and the stray inductances on your particular version of the receiver might be. So, from England we have, or from Britain anyway, we have the wonderful ham radio acronym S.O.T. And it stands for Select on Test. That's kind of what I guessed it was, but it was confirmed to me by many actual British radio amateurs who wrote in and said, yes, that's what it means. And I really like that. I really thought that, in a certain sense, sums up who we are as a group of knack victims. Many, many, many of our components are SOT. Yeah, there's a couple of jokes that go along those lines that begin with S-O. But we won't get into that because this is a family show. Before we get into the mailbag, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. Maybe I'll save that for the mailbag. Yeah. QRSS news. I'm happy to report that there are many more U.S. beacons and grabbers operating on the 10140. 000 hertz frequency range. Eldon, WA0UWH, is setting one up with using Linux. He's setting up a grabber based on Linux near Seattle. Lots of other grabbers are popping up, and I think one thing that needs to be done is the guys who maintain the grabber aggregators, these are the sort of one-stop shopping for QRSS grabbers. These sites that you could visit and see miniature displays of many of the grabber pages. We need to try to get the new North American grabbers put on these pages. So if you guys are putting up a new grabber somewhere in North America, and you think it's going to be up there and it's going to stay on there pretty much 24/7 indefinitely, let the guys who run the grabber aggregators know, and so we could add you to the collection, because it's great fun to be able to just pull up one computer screen and just at a glance see what's happening in that grabber down there in Tasmania, and or that one out in Seattle, and the other one in Perth, and ON5EX's machine up there in Belgium, and let's try to get those on there. Stu, N6TTO is on the air and was received by Mark, our friend from Brainwagon, from the Brainwagon blog, K6HX, a distance of 37 miles. A good start there, Stu. Congratulations. But Alpha Alpha 5 CK then chimed in and reported that he had received Stu's signal from significantly further away. So good things happening with the with QRSS, and I think everybody's having a lot of fun with that. I'm going to be working on my keyer and my beacon. Some days I want to run it on QRSS on 30, but I also have the urge to get back and do some beacon operations on 10 meters. And I have a beacon box that has, with one K1EL keyer, I have dual transmitters in there, one for 30 and one for 10, and I can switch bands with just the flip of a switch. So I'm going to be working with the keyer to get an appropriate beacon CW sequence in there to transmit on 10 meters. I like kind of regular old CW 10-meter beacons. God, and all this talk about whisper. Mark, K6HX on the Brainwagon blog, has some really great stuff about the great DX that's being achieved using the whisper version of QRSS. And it's really gotten me intrigued. I really wish I had had an SSB transmitter that I could use on 30 meters to get a whisper signal going. I think I'm going to have to build the SDR transceiver that the SoftRock guys sent me. This is going to provide the motivation for me to build this thing and get into surface mount and SDR and all that, so that I can get into the whisper fun on 30 meters. Even the terminology that they use is really alluring. You know, we have QRSS grabbers, but they have whisper listeners. How's that? Whisper listeners, man. That's just real radio talk. And Mark, for example, reports that he woke up in the morning and was having his coffee and looked at the whisper spots, because you get reports. You see, you get these automatic reports on where you were heard. And he found that his signal was heard by a WA2 station. But when he checked, the WA2 station was out on Wake Island in the Pacific. Oh, man. I got to get into whispers. Whispers are the way to go here, guys. All right. Now it's time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love
them. Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. A lot of mail coming in. Let me start here. This was a real blast from the past, a bit of nostalgia. Really delighted to receive this one. Brad, WA5PSA, he was our first confirmed listener. When Mike and I started this way back in 2006, we were really delighted. You know, you do something like a podcast, you send it out, and you have no sense of whether anybody listens to it or not. Especially in the beginning, we were really wondering whether we were just talking to ourselves and then putting files on the internet. But Brad sent us one of our first bits of feedback, and he told us that he listened to he was listening to the early episodes of Solder Smoke while jogging through Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Mike and I were just thrilled. Wow, we've created this thing, and Guy puts it into his MP3 player, and as he's jogging through Tulsa, Oklahoma, he's listening to us talk about turning HW8s into DSB rigs and things like that. So anyway, thanks very much, Brad. Glad you're still with us, and keep up the good work there, listening to Solder Smoke and jogging through Tulsa. Ted Alpha Juliet 8 Tango was one of the guys who told me that DeForest Lake is not Lee DeForest Lake. Thanks for that, Ted. Neil, K7AQK, yeah, went to a rally in Essex and for £2, UK, picked up a mystery box filled with very fine brew, fine business homebrew construction. He sent me pictures of it, and I just eyeballed it. The construction work was beautiful, and it looked to me like it was 6 meters based on the size of the coils. So he's going to look into that, but congratulations on that, Neil. Steve, WB6TNL, was one of the many people who found my chip extraction story both entertaining and excruciating, as I think Steve put it. And he said he actually made my suffering a bit worse because he said, next time, use a socket. You know, the worst thing was that when Tony Fishpool sent me that chip, it came with a socket. It came with a nice little socket there. And I thought to myself, man, if I had used that socket, I wouldn't have gone through this misery. Because when I realized that I put it in upside down, I could have just plucked it up, flipped it over, and put it back in. But I told Steve, I said, yeah, Tony had sent me a socket, but no, I wanted to go commando. Now, this is something I think only our American listeners will understand, or maybe the British listeners also. This is a Seinfeld television show reference. We won't go into the details here, but I guess I am the first to describe not using a socket in this kind of construction situation as going commando. Anyway, I realized later that the socket wouldn't have worked because you got to solder it on both sides of the board. Anyway, and Steve, yeah, going commando. Doug, WB5TKI, is another listener who wrote in about the chip extraction problem, and one of the many guys who told me what I should have done. I wish I had known. You see, my ham radio home brewing hasn't included a whole lot of 16-pin chips. So this is all new to me. It certainly hadn't included double-sided PC boards and anything. But here's a real good tip. When you get into this situation, you got to change one of these things. Don't do what I did. Don't try to get those little pin leads out. It's really rough. What you do is you go in there and you clip off each one of the 16 leads, and you try to clip it off as close to the actual IC as you can. Your objective is to have these little stumps, 16 little stumps sticking off the top of the board. And then what you do is you kind of go in there and straighten them out, and then you take the new chip and you just solder the leads of the new chip right onto the stumps of the old one. And then you don't have to worry about cleaning out the holes, and you're not going to lift off the leads, and you're not going to do all the agony that I did. Good idea, guys. I wish I had known that before, but hopefully, and this is one of the purposes of solder smoke, this will save others from the kind of suffering that I've gone through. All right, thanks, Doug, for that. Now, Paul, VK5PH chimes in from VK5 land, another one to confirm that my beloved Lake DeForest was not named for the hated Lee. Alpha Alpha 5 Radio Sierra, our good friend Ron Sparks down there in the Persian Gulf, talks about Billy's Linux web notebook and is pleased that Billy has gone Linux and urges him to stay away from the dark side. All right. Bill, Alpha Alpha Zero RQ. This is something that's going to be interesting to those who are interested in the solder aroma game. Bill reports that at his isolated QTH, occasionally he's had to resort to use of the hard stuff. We're talking about solder, guys. We're not talking about drugs or alcohol, but it's pretty much the same thing, isn't it? He's talking about the use in desperation on actual radio electronic circuitry of acid core solder. Bill, just say no. Just say no to acid core solder. Don't do it. We know it's tempting. We know that your friends will tell you that it's okay. Don't believe them. Acid core solder is the road to perdition. Don't do it. Just say no. And I wonder, what does it smell like? It can't have the nice friendly bouquet of a good 60-40 rosin core or multi-core, just say no to acid core solder. Thanks for sharing that with us, Bill. Scott Haley writes in and talks about Oliver Heaviside. Oliver Heaviside, interesting figure in ham radio history. We'll have to look into Oliver more. I read about him in the great book Einstein's Heroes that I talked about a while back. And in Einstein's Heroes, Heaviside comes across as a real working class hero. But one of the links that Scott Haley provide didn't present him in such a heroic light. He sort of came across as a really kind of almost prototypical or sort of quintessential technical antisocial geek. And to make matters worse, instead of being sort of a working class hero, he seemed to be, in this version, presented as a bit of a moocher who just lived off the work of his female relatives. So anyway, what's the verdict on Oliver Heaviside? I turn to our British colleagues for this. Is he as heroic as some pretended, or as some presented him, or was he a bit of a moocher? We'll see. Brent in Twin Cities reports that he's had the knack since age 5, but only recently found his way to ham radio. He spotted a small Wonder Labs rock mite. This caught his eye, and soon he was listening to Solder Smoke. The rest is history. He also provides some words of wisdom on chip extraction. Thanks, Brent. Dan, NM5DV, is getting ready to use a Soft Rock SDR radio for QRSS. Good luck with that, Dan. Jeff, K07M, listens to us. This is a new one. This is great. Jeff listens to Solder Smoke over the audio system of his general aviation aircraft while in flight. So Jeff is out there flying around Sevenland in a private airplane with pipe and Solder Smoke over the loudspeakers or over the headphone, I imagine. That is fantastic. He keeps a bag of gear with him for portable operations and reports that within 10 minutes of landing, he can be on the air on any band from 160 meters to 440 megahertz. A fine business, Jeff, and I hope the Solder Smoke keeps you company on many more flights. John, W6JE, wrote a great article for Electronic Design on the role of analog designers in our increasingly digital world. I've got a review of the article and links to it up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Edwin, WA4YHL, reports that Amateur Logic TV, episode number 23, has been produced and is on the air. Glad to hear that, and glad our friends from Amateur Logic TV are still in operation. Here's a good one. Dave, WA5DJJ, is building a QRS transmitter, and he asks about FSK keying. First, he had a really good question about how much frequency shift you should introduce on an FSK QRSS signal. The answer is about 5 hertz. And many guys chimed in and told Dave that about 5 hertz of shift is all you need to be visible on the bloggers. But the other question that he asked was even more important, and that is whether you should shift up or shift down. Now, most people shift up, and this produces a nice, when you look on the grabber screens, you see this line going across, and when the keyer is keyed, you see, boop, it jumps up a bit. So it's easy to read the code along the top of the line. This is the way most people do it. I, however, did it upside down because I really didn't think too much. I was still in my build design phase. I had not yet gotten to the design build phase. So when you do things backwards, your FSK ends up upside down. There's a certain symmetry to that. Anyway, that's what happened with mine, and it ended up upside down. So I warned Dave about that, and Dave came back with an interesting observation. He noted, that there might be a certain advantage of doing upside-down FSK keying, because then when the guys from Australia see you, they won't have to stand on their heads to read it. Hey, thanks, Dave. I didn't realize that My upside down FSK was actually inspired. Eddie, G3ZJO, who is one of the real gurus of QRSS and has some really great signals on the grabber, he comments on upside down FSK and notes with a certain note of disdain, probably appropriate disdain, that upside down FSK is, it makes your signal look like a washing that has been hung out to dry. All right. I guess I'll have to make my my FSK ups straight side up. Our last bit of solder smoke mail came in from our friend Jerry NR5A out there in South Dakota. He's gone completely minimalist. He's building rock mites and smaller rigs. The minimalist wave has hit him. He's very active in the minimalist radio group. And good luck to you, Jerry. It sounds like you're having a great time, and keep up the good work. Guys, we're over time here. We're at 1 hour and 5 minutes. The megabytes are piling up, so it's time to say 7-3 from the Eternal City. See you in a couple weeks. 7-3 from Rome.